The Third Eye by Tuesday Love Sang Rampa, read to you by Blue Friend. Chapter 2, End of My Childhood. Yulgi, you are pulling my head off. I shall be as bald as a monk if you don't stop. Hold your peace, Tuesday Love Sang. Your pigtail must be straight and well buttered, or your honorable mother will be after my skin. But, Yulgi, you don't have to be so rough. You are twisting my head off. Oh, I can't bother about that. I'm in a hurry. So there he was, sitting on the floor with the tough manservant winding me up by the pigtail. Eventually, the wretched thing was as stiff as a frozen yak and shining like moonlight on the lake. Mother was in a whirl, moving around so fast that I felt almost as if I had several mothers. There were last-minute orders, final preparations, and much excited talk. Yasso, 2 years older than I, was bustling about like a woman of 40. Father had shut himself up in his private room and was well out of the uproar. I wish I could have joined him. For some reason, Mother had arranged for us to go to the Jiuquan, the cathedral of Lhasa. Apparently, we had to give a religious atmosphere to the later proceedings. At about 10 in the morning, Tibetan times are very elastic, a triple-toned gong was sounded to call us to our assembly point. We all mounted ponies, Father, Mother, Yasso, and about 5 others, including a very reluctant me. We turned across the Lingkor Road and left at the foot of the Potala. This is a mountain of buildings, 400 feet high and 1,200 feet long. Past the village of Sho, we went, along the plain of the Kichu, until, half an hour later, we stood in front of the Jiuquan. Around it clustered small houses, shops, and stalls to lure the pilgrims. 1,300 years the cathedral had stood there to welcome the devout. Inside, the stone floors were grooved inches deep by the passage of so many worshippers. Pilgrims moved reverently around the inner circuit, each turning the hundreds of prayer wheels as they passed and repeating incessantly the mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum. Huge wooden beams, black with age, supported the roof, and the heavy odor of constantly burning incense drifted around like light summer clouds at the crest of a mountain. Around the walls were golden statues of the deities of our faith. Stout metal screens with a coarse mesh so as not to obstruct the view protected the statues from those whose cupidity overcame their reverence. Most of the more familiar statues were partly buried by the precious stones and gems which had been heaped around them by the pious who had sought favors. Candlesticks of solid gold held candles which burned continually and whose light had not been extinguished during the past 1,300 years. From dark recesses came the sound of bells, gongs, and the lowing bray of the conches. We made our circuit as tradition demanded. Our devotions completed, we went on to the flat roof. Only the favored few could visit here. Father, as one of the custodians, always came. Our form of governments, yes, plural, may be of interest. At the head of the state and church, the final court of appeal, there was the Dalai Lama. Anyone in the country could petition him. If the petition or request was fair, or if an injustice had been done, the Dalai Lama saw that the request was granted or the injustice rectified. It is not unreasonable to say that everyone in the country, probably without exception, either loved or revered him. He was an autocrat. He used power and domination, but never did he use these for his own gain, only for the good of the country. He knew of the coming communist invasion, even though it lay many years ahead, and temporary eclipse of freedom. That is why a very small number of us were specially trained so that the arts of the priests should not be forgotten. After the Dalai Lama, there were two councils. That is why I wrote governments. The first was the Ecclesiastical Council. The four members of it were monks of Lama status. They were responsible, under the inmost one, for all the affairs of the lamasaries and nunneries. All ecclesiastical matters came before them. The Council of Ministers came next. This council had four members, three lay and one cleric. They dealt with the affairs of the country as a whole and were responsible for integrating the church and state. Two officials, who may be termed prime ministers, for that is what they were, acted as liaison officers between the two councils and put their views before the Dalai Lama. They were of considerable importance during the rare meetings of the National Assembly. This was a body of some 50 men representing all the most important families and lamasaries in Lhasa. They met only during the gravest emergencies, such as in 1904, when the Dalai Lama went to Mongolia, when the British invaded Lhasa. In connection with this, many Western people have the strange notion that the inmost one was cowardly in running away. He did not run away. Wars on Tibet may be likened to a game of chess. If the king is taken, the game is won. The Dalai Lama was our king. Without him, there would be nothing to fight for. He had to go to safety in order to keep the country together. Those who accuse him of cowardice in any form simply do not know what they are talking about. The National Assembly could be increased to nearly 400 members when all the leaders from the provinces came in. There are five provinces. The capital, as Lhasa was often called, was in the province of Yusang. Shigatse is in the same district. Gartok is western Tibet. Chang is northern Tibet, while Kham and Lodzong are the eastern and southern provinces, respectively. With the passage of the years, the Dalai Lama increased his power and did more and more without assistance from the councils or assembly, and never was the country better governed. The view from the temple roof was superb. To the east stretched the plain of Lhasa, green and lush and dotted with trees. Water sparkled through the trees, the rivers of Lhasa tinkling along to join the Tsang Po 40 miles away. To the north and south rose the great mountain ranges, enclosing our valley and making us seem secluded from the rest of the world. Lamaseries abounded on the lower levels. Higher, the small hermitages perched precariously on the precipitous slopes. Westwards loomed the twin mountains of the Potala and the Chakpori. The latter was known as the Temple of Medicine. Between these mountains, the Western Gate glinted in the cold morning light. The sky was a deep purple, emphasized by the pure white of the snow on the distant mountain ranges. Light, wispy clouds drifted high overhead. Much nearer, in the city itself, we looked down on the council hall nestling against the northern wall of the cathedral. The treasury was quite near, and surrounding it all were the stalls of the traders and the market in which one could buy almost anything. Close by, slightly to the east, a nunnery jostled the precincts of the disposers of the dead. In the cathedral grounds, there was the never-ceasing babble of visitors to this, one of the most sacred places of Buddhism. The chatter of pilgrims who had traveled far and who now brought gifts in the hopes of obtaining a holy blessing. Some there were who brought animals saved from the butchers and purchased with scarce money. There is much virtue in saving life of animal and of man, and much credit would accrue. As we stood gazing at the old but ever new scenes, we heard the rise and fall of monks' voices in psalmody, the deep bass of the older men and the high treble of the acolytes. There came the rumble and the boom of the drums and the golden voices of the trumpets, skirlings and muffled throbs and a sensation as of being caught up in a hypnotic net of emotions. Monks bustled round, dealing with their various affairs, some with yellow robes and some in purple. The more numerous were in russet red. These were the ordinary monks. Those of much gold were from the Potala, as were those in cherry vestments. Acolytes in white and police monks in dark maroon bustled about. All, or nearly all, had one thing in common. No matter how new their robes, they almost all had patches which were replicas of the patches on Buddha's robes. Foreigners who have seen Tibetan monks, or have seen pictures of them, sometimes remark on the patched appearance. The patches, then, are part of the dress. The monks of the 1,200-year-old Nisar Lamasari do it properly and have their patches of a lighter shade. Monks wear the red robes of the order. There are many shades of red, caused by the manner in which the woolen cloth is dyed. Maroon to brick red, it is still red. Certain official monks, employed solely at the Potala, wear gold sleeveless jackets over their red robes. Gold is a sacred color in Tibet. Gold is untarnishable and so always pure, and it is the official color of the Dalai Lama. Some monks or high lamas and personal attendants on the Dalai Lama are permitted to wear gold robes over their ordinary ones. As we looked over the roof of the Jokang, we could see many such gold-jacketed figures, and rarely one of the peak officials. We looked up at the prayer flags fluttering, and at the brilliant domes of the cathedral. The sky looked beautiful, purple, with little flecks of wispy clouds, as if an artist had lightly flicked the canvas of heaven with a white-loaded brush. Mother broke the spell. "Well, we are wasting time. I shudder to think what the servants are doing. We must hurry." So, off on our patient ponies, clattering along the Lingkor Road, each step bringing me nearer to what I termed the ordeal, but which Mother regarded as her big day. Back at home, Mother had a final check of all that had been done, and then we had a meal to fortify us for the events to come. We well knew that at times such as these, the guests would be well filled and well satisfied, but the poor hosts would be empty. There would be no time for us to eat later. With much clattering of instruments, the monk musicians arrived and were shown into the gardens. They were laden with trumpets, clarinets, gongs, and drums. Their cymbals were hung around their necks. Into the gardens they went, with much chatter, and called for beer to get them into the right mood for good playing. For the next half hour, there were horrible honks and strident bleats from the trumpets as the monks prepared their instruments. Uproar broke out in the courtyard as the first of the guests were sighted, riding in an armed cavalcade of men with fluttering pennants. The entrance gates were flung open, and two columns of our servants lined each side to give welcome to the arrivals. The steward was on hand with his two assistants, who carried an assortment of the silk scarves which are used in Tibet as a form of salutation. There are 8 qualities of scarves, and the correct one must be presented, or offense may be implied. The Dalai Lama gives and receives only the first grade. We call these scarves kata, and the method of presentation is this. The donor, if of equal rank, stands well back with the arms fully extended. The recipient also stands well back with arms extended. The donor makes a short bow and places the scarf across the wrists of the recipient, who bows, takes the scarf from the wrists, turns it over in approval, and hands it to a servant. In the case of a donor giving a scarf to a person of much higher rank, he or she kneels with tongue extended, which is a Tibetan greeting similar to lifting the hat, and places the kata at the feet of the recipient. The recipient in such cases places his scarf across the neck of the donor. In Tibet, gifts must always be accompanied by the appropriate kata, as must letters of congratulation. The government used yellow scarves in place of the normal white. The Dalai Lama, if he desired to show the very highest honor to a person, would place a kata about a person's neck and would tie a red silk thread with a triple knot into the kata. If, at the same time, he showed his hands palms up, one was indeed honored. We Tibetans are of the firm belief that one's whole history is written on the palm of the hand, and the Dalai Lama, showing his hands thus, would prove the friendliest intentions towards one. In later years, I had this honor twice. Our steward stood at the entrance, with an assistant on each side. He would bow to new arrivals, accept their kata, and pass it on to the assistant on the left. At the same time, the assistant on his right would hand him the correct grade of scarf with which to return the salutation. This he would take and place across the wrists, or over the neck, according to the rank, of the guest. All these scarves were used and reused. The steward and his assistants were becoming busy. Guests were arriving in large numbers. From neighboring estates, from Lhasa City, and from outlying districts, they all came, clattering along the Linkhor Road to turn into our private drive in the shadow of the Potala. Ladies who had ridden a long distance wore a leather face mask to protect the skin and complexion from the grit-laden wind. Frequently, a crude resemblance of the wearer's features would be painted on the mask. Arrived at her destination, the lady would take her mask off, as well as her yak hide cloak. I was always fascinated by the features painted on the masks. The uglier or older the woman, the more beautiful and younger would be her mask features. In the house there was great activity. More and more seat cushions were brought from the storerooms. We do not use chairs in Tibet, but sit cross-legged on cushions, which are about 2.5 feet square and about 9 inches thick. The same cushions are used for sleeping upon, but then several are put together. To us, they are far more comfortable than chairs or high beds. Arriving guests were given buttered tea and led to a large room which had been converted into a refectory. Here, they were able to choose refreshments to sustain them until the real party started. About 40 women of the leading families had arrived, together with their women attendants. Some of the ladies were being entertained by mother, while others wandered around the house, inspecting the furnishings and guessing their value. The place seemed to be overrun with women of all shapes, sizes, and ages. They appeared from the most unusual places and did not hesitate one moment to ask passing servants what this cost or what that was worth. They behaved, in short, like women the world over. Sister Yaso was parading around in very new clothes, with her hair done in what she regarded as the latest style, but which to me seemed terrible. But I was always biased when it came to women. Certain it was that on this day they seemed to get in the way. There was another set of women to complicate matters. The high-class woman in Tibet was expected to have huge stores of clothing and ample jewels. These she had to display, and as this would have entailed much changing and dressing, special girls, called Chung girls, were employed to act as mannequins. They paraded round in mother's clothes, sat and drank innumerable cups of butter tea, and then went and changed into different clothing and jewelry. They mixed with the guests and became, to all intents and purposes, mother's assistant hostesses. Throughout the day, these women would change their attire perhaps 5 or 6 times. The men were more interested in the entertainers in the gardens. A troop of acrobats had been brought in to add a touch of fun. 3 of them held up a pole about 15 feet high, and another acrobat climbed up and stood on his head on the top. Then the others snatched away the pole, leaving him to fall, turn, and land cat-like on his feet. Mother appeared, leaving the rest of the ladies to see the entertainments and listen to the music. The latter was not difficult. The musicians were now well warmed up with copious amounts of Tibetan beer. For this occasion, Mother was particularly well dressed. She was wearing a yak wool skirt of deep russet red, reaching almost to her ankles. Her high boots of Tibetan felt were of the purest white, with blood-red soles and tastefully arranged red piping. Her bolero-type jacket was of a reddish-yellow, somewhat like Father's monk robe. In my later medical days, I should have described it as iodine on bandage. Beneath it, she wore a blouse of purple silk. These colors all harmonize and had been chosen to represent the different classes of monks' garments. Across her right shoulder was a silk brocade sash, which was caught at the left side of her waist by a massive gold circlet. From the shoulder to the waist knot, the sash was blood red, but from that point it shaded from pale lemon yellow to deep saffron when it reached the skirt hem. Around her neck she had a gold cord, which supported the 3 amulet bags which she always wore. These had been given to her on her marriage to my father. One was from her family, one was from Father's family, and one, an unusual honor, was from the Dalai Lama. She wore much jewelry because Tibetan women wear jewelry and ornaments in accordance with their station in life. A husband is expected to buy ornaments and jewelry whenever he has a rise in status. Mother had been busy for days past, having her hair arranged in 108 plaits, each one as thick as a piece of whipcord. 108 is a Tibetan sacred number, and ladies with sufficient hair to make this number of plaits were considered to be most fortunate. The hair, parted in the Madonna style, was supported on a wooden framework worn on top of the head like a hat. Of red lacquered wood, it was studded with diamonds, jade, and gold discs. The hair trailed over it like rambler roses on a trellis. Mother had a string of coral shapes depending from her ear. The weight was so great that she had to use a red thread around each ear to support it, or risk having the lobe torn. The earring reached nearly to her waist. I watched in fascination to see how she could turn her head to the left. People were walking about, admiring the gardens or sitting in groups discussing social affairs. The ladies in particular were busy with their talk. "Yes, my dear, Lady Doring is having a new floor laid. Finely ground pebbles polished to a high gloss. Have you heard that young Lama who was staying with Lady Rikasha, etc., etc.? But everyone was really waiting for the main item of the day. All this was a mere warming up for the events to come, when the priest astrologers would forecast my future and direct the path I should take through life. Upon them depended the career that I should undertake. As the day grew old, and the lengthening shadows crawled more quickly across the ground, the activities of the guests became slower. They were satiated with refreshments and in a receptive mood. As the piles of food grew less, tired servants brought more, and that too went with the passage of time. The hired entertainers grew weary, and one by one slipped away to the kitchens for a rest and more beer. The musicians were still in a fine fettle, blowing their trumpets, clashing the cymbals, and thwacking the drums with gay abandon. With all the noise and uproar, the birds had been scared from their usual roosting places in the trees. And not only the birds were scared, the cats had dived precipitately into some safe refuge with the arrival of the first noisy guests. Even the huge black mastiffs which guarded the place were silent, their deep baying stilled in sleep. They had been fed and fed until they could eat no more. In the walled gardens, as the day grew yet darker, small boys flitted like gnomes between the cultivated trees, swinging lighted butter lamps and smoke incense censers, and at times leaping into the lower branches for a carefree frolic. Dotted about the grounds were golden incense braziers, sending up their thick columns of fragrant smoke. Attending them were old women who also twirled clacking prayer wheels, each revolution of which sent thousands of prayers heavenwards. Father was in a state of perpetual fright. His walled gardens were famous throughout the country for their expensive imported plants and shrubs. Now, to his way of thinking, the place was like a badly run zoo. He wandered around wringing his hands and uttering little moans of anguish when some guest stopped and fingered a bud. In particular danger were the apricot and pear trees and the little dwarf apple trees. The larger and taller trees, poplar, willow, juniper, birch, and cypress, were festooned with streams of prayer flags which fluttered gently in the soft evening breeze. Eventually the day died as the sun set behind the far distant peaks of the Himalayas. From the lamasseries came the sound of trumpets signaling the passing of yet another day, and with it hundreds of butter lamps were set alight. They depended from the branches of trees, they swung from the projecting eaves of the houses, and others floated on the placid waters of the ornamental lake. Here they grounded like boats on a sandbar on the water lily leaves. There they drifted towards the floating swans seeking refuge near the island. The sound of a deep-toned gong, and everyone turned to watch the approaching procession. In the gardens, a large marquee had been erected with one completely open side. Inside was a raised dais on which were four of our Tibetan seats. Now the procession approached the dais. Four servants carried upright poles with large flares at the upper end. Then came four trumpeters with silver trumpets sounding a fanfare. Following them, mother and father reached the dais and stepped upon it. Then two old men, very old men, from the lamasery of the state oracle. These two old men from Nishang were the most experienced astrologers in the country. Their predictions have been proved correct time after time. Last week they had been called to predict for the Dalai Lama. Now they were going to do the same for a 7-year-old boy. For days they had been busy at their charts and computations. Long had been their discussions about trines, ecliptics, Cesis quadrates, and the opposing influence of this or that. I will discuss astrology in a later chapter. Two lamas carried the astrologer's notes and charts. Two others stepped forward and helped the old seers to mount the steps of the dais. Side by side they stood, like two old ivory carvings, their gorgeous robes of yellow Chinese brocade merely emphasized their age. Upon their heads they wore tall priest's hats, and their wrinkled necks seemed to wilt beneath the weight. People gathered around and sat on the ground on cushions brought by the servants. All gossip stopped as people strained their ears to catch the shrill, piping voice of the astrologer-in-chief. On he droned for an hour and then stopped for a 10-minute rest. For yet another hour he went on outlining the future. Halley, halley! Extraordinary, extraordinary! Exclaimed the entranced audience. And so it was foretold. A boy of 7 to enter a lamasery after a hard feat of endurance, and there be trained as a priest surgeon. To suffer great hardships, to leave the homeland and go among strange people. To lose all and have to start again, and eventually to succeed. Gradually the crowd dispersed. Those who had come from afar would stay the night at our house and depart in the morning. Others would travel with their retinues and with flares to light the way. With much clattering of hooves and the hoarse shouts of men, they assembled in the courtyard. Once again, the ponderous gates swung open, and the company streamed through. Growing fainter in the distance was the clop-clop of the horses and the chatter of their riders, until from without there was the silence of the night.